Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books in Political Science podcast. My name is Heath Brown. Today I'll be talking to a colleague, a friend, the author of The IMF, The WTO, and The Politics of Economic Surveillance. The book was published by Routledge. It has a very long name. If you had spelled out each of those acronyms, thankfully they haven't, because we all know what those acronyms are. Martin Edwards is the author, and I have the pleasure to have him on the phone right now. Martin, how are you doing?
I'm great, Heath. Thanks for taking the time. I'm a huge fan of this work.
I love that you've listened before. I love that I've finally had the chance to get you on the podcast because we have been colleagues for a while. How is South Orange? Maybe you can tell us about where you are and a little bit more about yourself, and then we'll talk about your very interesting book. So who are you, Martin Edwards?
Wow, that's a difficult one. So I'm an associate professor in the School of Diplomacy and International Relations at Seton Hall University. I've been here since 2006, have a degree, a PhD in political science from Rutgers, and when I'm not sort of thinking about the IMF, I am an associate editor for International Studies Quarterly, so it's my job to read manuscripts that come in from scholars and help them sort of navigate the path to publication.
Yeah, wonderful. And in 11 days, what will be happening to you?
Yes. In 11 days, I'll become department chair. And so my goal is to get through July 1, and hopefully there will be no hiccups, no stack of resignations on my desk, and we'll go from there.
Right, and how intimidating is it to have an incoming department chair just publish a book, right? That is the motivation that everyone needs, is to have their department chair as well published as you are.
It is one of the things that they want us to do to kind of set the tone. And so quite obviously, I can't set the tone for people being scholars if I'm, of course, not one myself.
So let's talk about this book. All these acronyms and this idea of economic surveillance. This is not a concept that I think is that firsthand for most political scientists, most people who aren't knowledgeable about the subject matter. So let's start right there. What is economic surveillance and who does it?
Okay, sure. So one of the things that international organizations do, period, is monitor countries, okay? And I use the word surveillance because that's actually the word that the IMF has always used to describe its practice, which does make it a little difficult because people hear surveillance and they think of Edward Snowden. I don't have any secret documents, nor is there a movie about me. But rather, it's the day-to-day work that international organizations do of monitoring countries. And this holds in all sorts of areas. This holds in human rights. This holds in the environment. My work is sort of more, I find the economic international organizations more interesting, and so I'm naturally drawn to them. So the day-to-day work of these organizations, which is separate from lending during crises, which is you commonly think of what the IMF does, or adjudicating trade disputes, which you normally think of as what the WTO does. It's this sort of work that I'm focusing on. And the reason why, you know, that it's not common among sort of political scientists is that it's kind of understudied. We tend to focus more on the crisis activities of these organizations and not their day-to-day work. So I wanted to call attention to that in this book.
Yeah, and there's this sort of give and take between these international organizations and countries, and the sharing of information, how much information is available, the accuracy of that information is much of what this book is about. You write at the start of the book, and I quote, "Just because a government is transparent does not make it virtuous." What does this mean exactly? And what are the implications of the transparency that governments have about economic policy and economic data, and their motivations for sharing it?
Yeah. Okay. All right. This is an interesting point. I think normally when we think about transparency, we always think about this as a good thing, right? And I think that's certainly true in many phases. Certainly of our individual lives, it'd be great if you knew what a car actually costs before you purchase it. That the relationship between countries and these organizations that they themselves have created is a different one than you and I as consumers. And so what that means is they are, in the case of the IMF, for example, the fact that I can even study this material is a development in my lifetime, right? That countries have chosen to let these reports become public. And that involved a lot of wheeling and dealing behind the scenes, where member countries said, okay, fine, if we, how do we do this in a way that doesn't harm us if our economy is actually deteriorating? And also at the same time, countries have incentives sometimes to misrepresent. Greece did this most notably with the European Commission, which was one of the things that led that it sort of stated that things were not as bad as they turned out to be, which sort of deepened its own financial crisis. So, transparency we have to realize that governments choose transparency. And so with that, it's not necessarily the magic bullet that we assume that it's going to be.
And who is looking to this information? Who's using this information? The IMF and WTO and others are sort of processing this. They're then issuing reports. Who might be reading those reports? Why is all of this? Why does it matter?
Again, one of the things that these organizations are trying to do is steer the global economy, right? The WTO focusing more on trade openness, the IMF wanting to make sure that countries adopt policies that are consistent with growing the world economy without harming each other, right? That's sort of a legacy of, World War II. We learned that economic cooperation between countries unraveled. And obviously that was problematic. Right? That's an outgrowth of the Great Depression, which is, kind of when we started to create these organizations in the first place. The WTO came along a little later, but that's the sort of the genesis. So who reads these reports? These reports are read by other member governments. They find them as information. I talked to the IMF about this. One of the staffers told me, do not think for a moment that other countries don't care about what we say about the world's largest economy. And I thought that was really telling. Financial markets, can respond to this work instantly. And, in emerging market economies, it's as these reports are released, and depending what the tone of them are, financial markets respond accordingly. Countries, also sometimes respond to these reports in other ways. Most notably last year, when the fund was releasing its sort of its preliminary findings on the U.S. economy. On the other side of town, the Treasury Secretary issued a statement critiquing the IMF for having the audacity to question that we can't have 5% growth and that, you know, the tax cuts might not have been a good idea. So there is obviously this give and take. And so, you know, there are folks looking at this. I think the challenge is that the influence of this information, and this is kind of one of the bottom lines of the book, doesn't percolate as far as we might like. We always think about, you know, scholars think about international organizations as they provide this information. Okay, so if that's true, then you would expect that we might talk about this in the media, or members of Congress might reference the findings of these reports. And what I consistently find is that the media and certainly the U.S. Congress, as kind of a sine qua non for domestic actors, don't use this information in, they don't reference it in their decision making. So that's obviously a challenge. We want the fund and the WTO want this enterprise to be successful, but just because you release information doesn't necessarily mean politicians are going to change their mind as a result of things that you suggest.
Now, this raises another sort of larger context of the book and why this matters right now, which is the rise of populism. Mm-hmm. That has been taken different forms in different places. But what is often thought of as a largely domestic trend. But you suggest that it has something to do with the role of these international organizations and the role of the information that they're sharing. So what does populism have to do with this?
Oh, that's a good question. I do think that what these organizations are pronouncing is a verdict on the economy that is thought to be impartial, that is separate from what the White House or a member of the president's economic team might say. So to the extent to which that is a critique, that is a challenge, right? That reporters that were covering this, this mundane review of the U.S. economy last year, their phones all lit up at the moment that Secretary Mnuchin issued this press release, basically saying we disagree with the fund's bottom line. So to the extent to which that is an impartial and, a technocratic view of government policies, this is something that countries can push back on. And the WTO is the same thing, functions in the same way. It released a review of the U.S. economy at the end of the year, and in the discussions of those reports, there were all sorts of member countries who were critical of the U.S. for adopting policies that are closing off trade rather than expanding it, or for stifling reform of the WTO itself. And I just remember reading the transcript of this, and I was just sort of struck by the fact that the Chinese ambassador to the WTO referenced Stan Lee, and he said, the Stan Lee quote on Spider-Man, which is, with great power comes great responsibility. And he's saying that the U.S. has great power, but it's not behaving responsibly. And it was just sort of, it's a remarkably different world sometimes comparing these reports, which are often very subdued, right? They're not designed to be scathing or critical or even newsy with how governments respond to this, which is a little more inflammatory and a whole lot less diplomatic.
Now, this does raise the sort of the empirics of the book. You collected some varied information. Where did you collect this information, and what did you exactly measure when it came to these different reports and the reaction to them?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's a tricky thing to get at, right? Because you can't really ask. You can ask policymakers in some sense. Do you listen to these things? But then you have to think, okay, that's modulated, and that might not actually represent reality. So what I looked at was how financial markets respond, and this is a straightforward econometric test using available data on interest rates. I looked at how sort of the effect of releasing trade policy reviews on potential trade disputes by looking at whether or not governments break or bend international trade rules, and then whether they initiate disputes later on. And those are straightforwardly political science-y empirical tests. For a lot of the work on influence and on effects on the media is intentionally a little more descriptive, because there I'm just trying to get a sense of, hey, if we think about these organizations as providing information, then is it the case that we actually see these reports referenced in the media? And I look at LexisNexis searches for U.S. and foreign news publications, and I look at information sources on Capitol Hill to get a sense of are these works referenced in congressional discussions as well. And so, as a way, and that's a little more descriptive, but that does get the claim about whether the information that these organizations are transmitting has some resonance domestically.
And do they? And if they do, or if they don't, what is likely to get one of these economic surveillance reports to show up in a news outlet? And what kind of news outlets are we looking at here? Is this the major newspapers or more of the trade presses?
Yeah, I actually find that it's the more specialized works are where you actually see traction. So electronic newsletters on the Hill that cover trade will certainly talk about what's in a trade policy report, right? And those are referenced more for specialists. But but at the same time, this doesn't make the newspapers. And it is kind of interesting because in a very real sense, since these reports are public, they do try to craft them increasingly in a way that makes them readable. And if you can figure out what's going on with the economy by reading the Washington Post, this is not a great reach for you. Okay. So, but that challenge is that there's not a whole lot of resonance there. And as folks in DC have said, there used to be a guy who wrote about this, and he's no longer at the Post, and they sort of changed his beat. So he's not; they no longer have a dedicated IMF person, and so that's kind of why that you see some of these low levels of media engagement. But I do think in some sense, as a check on what governments are saying, the fact that these reports don't have the oomph that one might think is a little disquieting. And certainly these institutions are concerned about that. Both of them are trying to think, okay, how do we make sure that our findings are engaging the public in different ways? And so they're wrestling with this challenge, mindful that they have to think about how to package it and present it expert fashion.
And what would change if there was more resonance, if there was salience that came from the release of these reports? What do they anticipate changing, and why do they view that as a positive change?
Mm-hmm. Well, what these organizations are after is making sure that their advice has traction. That's sort of their goal. What would that look like? That would look like their proposals being discussed or their proposals even being referenced more substantively. And I'll give you a sort of a concrete example. the preliminary findings on the U.S. economy for this year were just released a week and a half ago. And there was a lot of discussion on inequality in them, which is kind of revolutionary for the fund, because normally we don't think of this organization as particularly caring a great deal about inequality. But there was a lot in there that you would find having resonance with a whole lot of campaign speeches right now. You know, how do we ensure better jobs? How do we ensure higher quality worker training? There's a straightforward advocacy for a carbon tax, which is also kind of interesting because you know sort of politically that that's not happening with, you know, the Congress and the president with this makeup. So I do think that what these organizations want is kind of maybe not countries unequivocally adopting their ideas, but they do want influence and sort of a greater acknowledgement of their findings. That look like? That would look like these findings actually being covered and countries and politicians responding to it. I think that the challenge is for these organizations that they don't devote as much effort into communicating these results, especially with established, capitalist economies, perhaps as they should. And so, the challenge is, well, since the U.S. is never going to borrow from the IMF, how do we ensure that the things that we say, even about, making sure that the financial system is more stable, right, that these things are things that politicians care about?
Yeah, it seems to be an obvious solution here, which is the Economic Surveillance Podcast. If you launched the Economic Surveillance Podcast, you would reach the world. Until then, Martin's book, The IMF, the WTO, and the Politics of Economic Surveillance, is available from Routledge. The book is published this year. Martin, thank you so much for your time today.
All right. Thank you so very much, Heath.